This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're here with our co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Today, we're talking with Dr. David Kirkland on a series of topics. We're going to be talking to you about shifting cultural narratives, transforming education in the school system to meet the needs of people of color, especially Black males, and language and literacies on this particular episode. So thank you so much, Dr. Kirkland, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, you know, I've been, you know, when we do these shows, I really dig into the research. So I feel like I know you because I've seen you on YouTube so much with your brilliant smile. But anyway, if you could just share a little bit about your background.
Yeah.
And who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. So David Kirkland, pronouns he, him, and his. And I do want to acknowledge, you know, that I'd stand on the shoulders of amazing people. I cannot give my introduction or my biography without first acknowledging the Black women, you know, who have ushered me into the place that I get to sit in today and all the people who have come before me. I am a professor of urban education. I'm also the CEO and founder of Forward ED, which is an education advocacy organization here out of New York City. I've been a longtime teacher working in the K-12 public school system for transformative racial and educational justice. And I'm happy, inspired, and glad to be here with you all today.
Oh, excellent. That was just wonderful. And I'm sure your passion and energy is just, people can feel it. So thank you so much. Now, I have a question about your advocacy work. Now, you do advocacy work for intersectional infrastructure and mindsets. Could you unpack that? The idea of intersectionality, what does that mean?
Thank you so much for that question. First, let me just define advocacy, because advocacy mm-hmm. becomes a bad word, especially mm-hmm. when you're talking about social science and you're talking to, you know, a sociologist. Sociologists and people in the academy, they think about advocacy as the light work. They think about it as the work that we should not be doing.
Really?
We should be doing. Yeah. They believe that we should be doing larger intellectual projects that build theory. Awesome. However, if you look at the communities that we come from, our children are in trouble. They're in peril. If you think about Black males, for instance, the suicide rates, the death rates, the incarceration rates, the jobless rates, and we can go on to begin to talk about, you know, all the rates. But then when we begin to talk about Black women who we delete from the conversation, and this is where the intersectional racial justice comes from, we talk about Black women not only being, you know, implicated by racial oppression, but also gender oppression. And then you begin to talk about LGBTQ Black women, right? Trans Black women, they are implicated even more. And then you put poverty into the conversation, and we have layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of oppressions that intensifies the experience of the oppressed within our communities. So what do we do? Well, we take all of the complexity. We look at that complexity in its face. We uplift and raise the voices of those individuals who in our communities have been historically silenced and marginalized in order for them to have a platform, in order to argue on their behalf and on the behalf of others like them, that justice is theirs too. What do we do for the voiceless?
Yeah, David, could you talk a little bit more about the relationship between power and intersectionality?
Yeah, intersectionality is very much about power. You can't talk about oppression, any kind of oppression, racial oppression, gender oppression, economic oppression in isolation, that these things have amplifying effects as they match onto one another. And so when we begin to talk about, you know, power and the disempowered, it's a different conversation that we must have if we're talking about a male who has gender power of color versus a woman of color who is both implicated by oppressive systems that oppress them both in terms of their gender and their race. Power is the conversation.
So talking about gender oppression with Black women, can you elaborate on what that sounds like, what that is?
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. we see it every day.
Right.
It's easy for us when we begin to think about the Black Lives Matter movement or mm-hmm. other movements toward racial justice to, you know, think about that movement using the face of Trayvon Martin mm-hmm. or using the face of Michael Brown But we don't usually think about Renisha McBride and some other Black women who also are implicated by the same kind of violence that young Black men have been implicated. The question is, where does our amnesia come from when it comes to the legitimate stories and experiences of people who happen to be, who happen to identify as women and who are also Black and who also face various kinds and different kinds of racial oppression because they are Black and because they are women?
And this goes directly into We Wear the Mask. Darrell, yeah, you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Before I talk about that, though, I wanted to lift up just because a person or organization can come out as anti-racist or anti-oppression, that doesn't mean that they're pro-Black.
That's right.
And that's a huge distinction and is very important when we're talking about the validity.
Could you unpack that, what you just said about that?
Yeah, just because you're anti-racist doesn't mean you're pro-Black. It's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. You can be, let's say, I'm going to use a trite metaphor, a trite analogy. Forgive the analogy, but I'm going to make the analogy anyway. Let's say you're in a relationship and that relationship is with a partner and this partner happens to be abusive. And his partner goes and becomes a non-abusive partner. Stop being abusive. That does not make it that partner a good partner. It's one thing to stop being abusive. It's an entirely different thing to be a good partner. It's one thing to be anti-racist. It's a whole other thing to be pro-Black.
So I want to spit some bars here from one of the greatest MCs of all time. So Paul Laurence Dunbar. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile. A mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise? And counting all our tears and sighs. Nay, let them see only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but oh, great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet and the long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask protects us. Why shouldn't we wear it? What does this mean for you, Dr. Kirkland, especially as someone who has navigated institutions like academia, which is notorious for the harm that it causes Black and brown bodies? You know, what does a poem like We Wear the Mask mean to you?
And can I say that it helps us not be vulnerable?
There's a tragedy that, you know, one of our aspirations when we wake up every day is survival. What about life and thriving? Dunbar's poem is a tragic poem. We wear the mask that grins and lies. Mm. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. It hides who we are. It's not okay for me to be me in society. Society has told me this. With torn and bleeding hearts, we smile. With mouth with myriad subtleties, why should the world be overwise and counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. You can only see me when I'm masked. Fanon writes this book called Black Skin, White Mask, that we can only be accepted. We can only be acceptable when we do things that conform to your acceptance. And there's a tragedy in that.
Don't all of us wear masks? I get our pain. But well, we talk about mask a lot.
It's a tricky dynamic because in one sense, there's a power and vulnerability that then you're open to things. But there's also a cultural aspect that is in some ways dangerous to a lot of extent. And yes, we do all wear certain masks in society.
Frantz Fanon, he writes in Black Skin, White Mask about the tragedy of this, about the tragedy of our having to wear a mask. And I won't compare, you know, the Black mask to all the masks that other groups have to wear. That comparison would be, you know, unfortunate and unfair. I'm going to talk about the mask that, you know, Black folk have to wear in the poem that Paul Laurence Dunbar is talking about, because I think it's important. It's saying that I can only be accepted, not for who I am, but only on terms that you are. Let me put this another way. I can show up in a room and I can speak the language that my grandmother says, I love you in. My grandmother used to say, I love me some you. I can go to a school today and a teacher tell me that's not the correct way to speak. However, if I put a mask on my language, I can be accepted or at least seen as acceptable only so far. What's wrong with me being able to say the language that my grandmother, you know, says I love you in? Not being able to speak that language within all, what does that say about me? That I always have to wear a mask. And the other thing is that We, within Black and brown communities, have these kind of horror stories, what Jordan Peele calls social tragedies, that are littered throughout our community. The concept of woke, if you think about what woke is, if we have to be woke, that's Freddy Krueger's Nightmare on Elm Street. That you can't sleep, that you don't have, you, if you rest, you can place yourself at risk. So you have to stay woke just so you can stay alive. I have to wear a mask. You can't see me just so I can be accepted by me. I got to put a bag over my head just so you can accept me.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Dr. Kirtland.
I wanted to kind of dig into the mask, though, right? At what point does the individual say, I'm not doing that? You know, at some point, the choice is on us.
Well, is it? Of course the choice is ours, right? Of course the choice is ours. But the issue is, you know, and this is the permanent issue, when we take the bag off of our head, we find that there are a lot of rifles aimed at us in this country that loves its rifles and its guns. And when the people that take the bags off their heads, you know, end up, you know, no longer alive. And I don't want to be crude about the point that we do things and have done things in this, you know, society that we have found ourselves in, you know, for our survival. Dunbar is speaking about, you know, this kind of tragic, you know, kind of posture, this gaze, this activity that we engage so that we can survive. There's a beauty that there is a persistence of survival. So much so that sociologists, we're talking about our kids need resilience. I'm like, Black kids got so much resilience.
Yes.
But there's a tragedy in it.
I wanted to go into something that you were saying about the language that you, your grandmother speaks. You can't bring that to school.
Yes.
Let's talk about, do Black lives matter in the classroom?
Do Black lives matter in the classroom? Right. Well, it really depends in, on the classroom that you into, right? So do Black lives matter in classroom?
I guess generally speaking,
if we look at the data, if we look at the data, we don't. Where Black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls. Black boys are 3 times more likely to be suspended from school than white girls. When we begin to look at the graduation rates, the achievement rates, all of the desirable statistics, we find ourselves at the bottom. And all of the least desirable statistics, we find ourselves at the top. Based on what the outcome data is saying, we don't matter, right? We go to schools that have not been well designed for us. There's a report that came out today talking about the civic crash, right? That in history and social studies, you know, for the first time in 19 plus years, you know, kids have performed least well. Well, what does that mean? That means that we have entire systems that have suggested that there is something wrong with our babies. But to be sure, the babies aren't broken. But too often, the systems that we send them to are our babies are not loved in school. And the statistics show it.
So I want you to comment about, we'd like to comment about this. This recent news that came out about the College Board stripping out Black Lives Matter out of the advanced placement for African American studies. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a complicated conversation. You know, the conversation about the College Board stripping out, you know, certain things, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, you know, from their African American studies, you know, AP program has far-reaching implications. They currently seated that they had, you know, bent under or folded under the pressure of Florida, which is a, you know, a large state and a big customer, you know, for the College Board. So it was an unfortunate moment, you know, in U.S. history. But the bigger issue is this. It's not just the College Board not including, you know, African-American studies, or at least key pieces of African-American studies that have been written by, you know, African-American people within their, you know, curriculum. The bigger question is, who gets to write the curriculum that our kids are learning from? Why is this a conversation anyway? Why don't I control the means of both mental and material production when it comes to my learning? Why does someone else get to make, you know, decisions for me? We believe that those who are most implicated by a decision that gets made that influences me should be part of that decision-making process. And we have constructed for the least powerful people in this country this wall where they do not get to participate in the decision-making that happens to them. We believe that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And if I'm closest to the solution about what is best to teach me, and you never ask me about what is best to teach me, then the problem is not me. The bigger problem is that the college board has the authority to say what constitutes Black history and what doesn't. That's shame.
Mm. Kind of thinking about being close to solutions, I feel like you've been close to solutions your entire career. When I first met you, you were executive director of the Metro Center at New York University, and now you've started Forward ED. Now, I would love to learn a little bit more about Forward ED, what inspired you to create the organization, and some of the current work that Forward ED is also doing.
Thank you so much for that question, Darrell. So Forward ED is my, you know, new organization. It's my most recent organization. And we created Forward ED because we believe that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And we believe that we can move forward together. There are two kinds of advocacy work. One kind of advocacy work is the advocacy work that that dominated my career. And that is about critiquing the system as it exists. And we've done all of the critical work. The other type of advocacy work is about transforming that system. How can we build and find solutions for ourselves in order to move ourselves forward? Because as I said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. This is the agency that we need. And so with Forward ED, we're thinking about ways that we can rebuild our own schools, the ways that we can shift mindsets, we can shift policies, we can shift practices, the ways that we can shift culture on our terms in order to create the schools not that we not only deserve, but also the schools that deserve us.
Hmm.
Right. And so this is what we're doing at Forward ED. We're doing transformative justice work and not just critical justice work. It's not good enough anymore to critique the system if you don't have anything to say about resolving the issues that so many of us face.
I love what you said, predict the future. The best way to predict the future is to invent it.
Yeah, that's
oh, from, man, Alan, that's a real snap right there.
Alan Kay, computer scientist, Alan
Kay. That's fantastic.
He was emeritus from Apple. But yeah, it's a great quote. But you know, I assume it also includes policy too, that the work you guys do. Yes.
So we do a lot of policy work, you know, both policy analysis work, you know, using social science techniques, you know, in order to do policy revision. You know, much of that work is about how can we incorporate and include, you know, various voices, the intersection of voices that we've talked about, right? Of individuals, who have been deleted from the conversation. So Forward ED works closely with communities, work closely with schools, puts communities in conversation with schools based on, you know, a humanizing, culturally responsive and sustaining framework of methodology that creates change and transformation throughout systems. Again, we believe that nothing is wrong with us. There ain't nothing wrong with me, but the system that I live in is broken.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
And we're talking to Dr. Kirtland.
I want to talk to you about what you talked about when it came to Christian language and literacies. And you wrote something about the delicate dance of faith. And you talked about the language of the Bible. Can you elaborate on that?
The reason why the relationship between language and faith is complex is because language and faith are complex, right? You know, there are these spaces where so much competition is had, where, you know, so many viewpoints around freedom and oppression, you know, get played out. We see language as a battleground. I was just in conversation with somebody in the hallway. You know, and we were talking about language. We were talking about African-American language. And then they said that, you know, Black language is a dialect. And I said, no, I don't see Black language as a dialect. And they said, why don't you see Black language as a dialect? I said, because that's a political question. Right. So if we take a language like Chinese and it's, you know, 14 or so different variants or dialects, some of them aren't mutually intelligible. So Cantonese and Mandarin, the two dominant, you know, varieties of Chinese, aren't mutually intelligible, and yet they're called dialects instead of separate languages. If you take Norwegian and Swedish, two languages that are mutually intelligible, they're called two separate languages. And so what we know is that what constitutes a language is not mutual intelligibility, but who has an army and a navy. So we've already weighed into like kind of like political waters when it comes to language. And the other thing that I heard in the hallway was that Black language was another version of American language or American English. And I said, the language that I speak is not a version of American English.
Reminds me of a story of these Native American protesters in Montana, and they were protesting on the oil or something like that. And some woman come up to him yelling at him to go back where they come from.
That's right. It's like, you know, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And so what I began to say is that, you know, what I speak isn't a version, or my language is not a broken version or a subverted version of some other language. Why don't we see and begin to see the conversation another way? Why isn't it in a language that is spoken in America, a dialect of Black language? And when we begin to have that conversation, then we can have some of the larger, complex political conversations. And I can make a full-on argument that American language is a dialect of Black language. And people get quiet when I have this conversation because we don't want to. And so faith and language, these really complex places, sit at the intersection of where we are having battles, where we feel most uncomfortable, not only where we're having battles and where we feel most uncomfortable, that everybody gravitate to these kinds of things, these constructs in order to frame and fight for an idea that benefits their interests. And what I'm saying is that we can't look at that ground as unsaturated. That ground is not political ground. That ground is very much political. And it depends on where you're looking at and your standpoint is how you will understand the relationship between those things.
Right. Power of the word. Yeah. So I want to ask you a little bit, you know, since we're talking about languages, that what kind of approaches do you use within language that you aid in success of your students and to help them unlearn bias?
So, so I usually teach Black and brown students, you know, and when I'm not teaching Black and brown students, I teach, you know, about a love for, you know, everybody, including Black and brown students, which becomes, you know, foreign in the content of our teaching. If you think about most of the curriculum throughout the United States, most of it is, you know, teaches us to really love white folk. And just love white folk, what they say, what they do, love white language, white expression, you know, from Shakespeare on, and teach us to hate, on the other end, you know, Black folk. This is what we call white supremacy and anti-Blackness, these kind of like two poles that sit within our curriculum. Well, my argument is that we can love everybody. And not only can we love everybody, we need to love everybody. And I want to emphasize a love for, you know, those individuals that through our structures, our systems, our curricula, you know, we are taught to hate. So I teach us to love us. Love Black language. Love Black hair. Love Black neighborhoods. Love Black genius. Love Black joy. Love, you
Say
know,
it loud,
Black,
I'm Black
pleasure.
And I'm proud.
That's
know?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, beyond just saying it loud, yes. I'm Black and I'm proud. You know, not only, you know, am I proud, I'm worthy. And I'm worthy of love.
You know, one of the things that this is making me think about is who gets to decide what problems are worthy of solutions. One of the questions that it makes me also sort of think about to ask you is like, who gets to be liberated in this system and who doesn't? You know, in many respects, and particularly when we think about Black men, you know, we're still suffering from the educational systems that's failing us.
Yeah, I love that question, right? The question, it asks at least two things. It asks, you know, like what is currently happening to us, you know, within school structures. You know, our current structure of school, Black men are not okay. We're just not okay in our current school structure, and we need to say it and we need to call it out, right? We're so much so not okay that, you know, more of us do not finish school. I think there's only two other groups in this country that don't finish school more than Black men, and that's Latin American men and Latino men and Native American men. And that's for different reasons than what we see, you know, with Black men. And then when we follow the life course after school, the joblessness, the apathy, you know, the incarceration rates, the death rates, as I've already talked about, we know that there is a problem. So there is a problem with what's going on in school. And too often we tell a lie that that problem is Black men. We look at people who look like me. As soon as we speak our piece, we're called angry. I smile a lot. I'm not angry.
You know, I was thinking that as you said that But what is our answer? You know, I'm a mother of a black boy, a black son. Yeah, I love black men, please, you know. But it's clear there is a real societal onslaught when it comes to just the negativity and blah, blah, blah. But yet, I really, how do we make the difference? Where do we shift it? It starts at home.
Well, I think a lot of things can happen at home to help. Mm-hmm. But when you live in a society that's broken, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. it's not clear to me that what you do at home will insulate you from the types of targeted attacks that have been designed within the system to take down particular individuals for the fact that they are who they are. And that is the issue. I got a PhD and I was running down to a subway and a cop stopped me, helped me up from getting to, you know, a meeting I was running to and asked me, why was I running? I looked suspicious. My mama told me what to do when I, you know, and when I'm in those situations, but it felt really dehumanizing to me. And what does that do to my soul when I follow my home instructions? I survive, but now I'm stepping fetching, right? I have to put my head down. I don't have the dignity or the humanity to raise up my chin and poke out my chest like I want to. So those home lessons aren't the problem. And they may not be the solution. The solution is getting the systems that we have in place inside of our society change where they see the dignity of everybody that lives inside of this country. And how do we do that? We have to begin to grapple with that tough question. And it's not going to feel good to everybody.
You got that right. It's not going to feel good to everybody.
So it's like the home lessons really are about strategies for survival as opposed to dealing with systemic change.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, David, I had a question for you too. It's, you know, it's that old African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. Your whole career has been about going far together and working with people. How do you actually build the necessary groundswell for movements to take place? Obviously, you're doing it at Ford Ed, but for someone who might be looking for strategy, like how do you begin to build that tribe or build that community?
Yeah, yeah. I asked three questions. There's three questions. Three questions I want to sit with everybody as we begin to think about building, you know, moving forward. The first question is a personal question. What can I do? What can I
do? Yes.
Right? It's a personal question.
Yes. Yes.
The second question is a structural question. What can I do? Right? Within the system, within the confines that I'm working within, what can I do? And the last question is a strategies question. What can I do? What can I do? What strategies do I have at my disposal? Three questions. What can I do personally? What can I do structurally? What can I do strategically in order to impact and affect change within a situation? Three questions.
You know, we're going to have to wrap, but I have to say you're powerful. Thank you for your powerful voice. And thank you so much, Dr. Darrell Cooper, for guest hosting. And thank you, Dr. David Kirkland. We will see all of you next time on Art Moves.
Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Koslansky and our distinguished co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.